Bureau, The Sweet Science of Racism in Haiti, a documentary prepared by Robert Knight and offered this evening as a rebroadcast from the original 2010 offer of the program. 212-209-2950. For those of you who have already received your copy of this documentary, you might want to also pledge for a DVD, An Unbroken Agony, Haiti from Revolution to the Kidnapping of a President, for your $100 pledge, or the book The Black Jacobians for a $100 pledge. Aristide and the Endless Revolution, a DVD for $100, when you call that number, 212-209-2950. And remember to tune in again for further illustrations of this historical documentation, The Sweet Science of Racism in Haiti, with historical perspectives on the architects of Haitian racism. And it's produced by Robert Knight. Stay tuned. Coming up will be Hour of the Wolf by Jim Fry.
Hey, this is Shaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And now it is time for Hour of the Wolf.
Thomas the Rhymer, up and come.
And yes, this is Hour of the Wolf, but this is not Jim Freund. I'm Ken Gale, and I'm sitting in for Jim today. He's fine. He just can't make it. And I'm Ken Gale, and I used to do Nuff Said here on WBAI, and every once in a while, sub for Jim Freund. Normally, I do Ecologic and Environmental Show every other Tuesday at 8 p.m. And I have the usual movie review, so let's go right to that. And then Mercy Van Vlack and I will be talking about H.P. Lovecraft.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Terry Gilliam's new film, The Zero Theorem, marks the second time this year Tilda Swinton has donned an outlandish disguise to play a supporting character, the first being, of course, in Snowpiercer. I'm not sure what her compulsion is that she wants to conceal her exotic, somewhat ambiguous beauty under crazy wigs and layers of prosthetics. Maybe she just has a fetish for silicon or Coke bottle eyeglasses. In Zero Theorem, she plays Dr. Shrink-Rom, a computerized virtual psychotherapist counseling the film's hero, Cohen Leth, played by Christoph Waltz. And let's just say she's as effective in her work as was the robotic shrink from Space Station 76, the film I talked about a couple of weeks ago. And Cohen, whose name, by the way, is spelled Q-O-H-E-N, cute, huh? Could use some emotional buttressing. He's living in the expected Gilliam dystopia, an overconnected future where advertisements follow you down the street on block-long video screens, and the workplace has become so clogged with flat displays that each cramped cubicle looks like the TV showroom at your local Best Buy. Cohen would prefer not to have any of that. He's a recluse, living in an abandoned church, and instead of working at his soul-sucking job as entity cruncher for the monolithic Mancom Corporation, he'd rather be hovering over his tricked-out telephone, waiting for contact by a mysterious caller that, he hopes, will provide meaning to his life. Yes, he's a man waiting for his call, and it's to the film's credit that it doesn't play coy with how heavy-handed that metaphor is. Anyway, management, in the person of Matt Damon, gives him the opportunity for a cyber commute gig, and Cohen leaps at the chance. Unfortunately, the job turns out to be an attempt to confirm the Zero Theorem, a proposition that states that the sum total of the universe adds up to nothing. And if that task isn't maddening enough, it comes with invaders to Cohen's fortress of solitude, including management's wired-in teenage son, played by Lucas Hedges, and a virtual call girl, played by Melanie Thierry, who's really, when you think about it, not all that virtual. In interview, Terry Gilliam has admitted that there's a clear parallel between the Zero Theorem and his dystopic classic Brazil. And indeed, there's the callous, monolithic entity that cares little for the victims ground up in its cogs, and a fantasy world, here a bucolic island getaway for our heroes to escape to, regardless of whether that's to their ultimate benefit. But where Brazil focused on humanity being crushed under the heel of a callous and incompetent bureaucracy, Zero Theorem tries to explore the repercussions of a world ruled by omnipresent corporations, where every thought becomes a marketable commodity and privacy is non-existent. Unfortunately, Gilliam hasn't quite managed to get a handle on his themes here. Part of it is that corporate intrusion with its veneer of seeming benevolence doesn't seem quite as frightening as a fascism that doesn't know its butt from its elbow. Steven Spielberg actually better managed to capture both the humor and the horror of a system that follows you everywhere in Minority Report. The other problem is that Cohen's futile quest for the call that would define his life and his ambivalence about the Zero Theorem project throughout the film, he oscillates between obsession and revulsion with the task, doesn't really invite much sympathy. He's nowhere near Brazil's Sam Lowry, whose attempts to impose his romantic fantasies on the harsh reality around him generated an empathy in the audience that made the critique of the human predilection to avoid rather than confront adversity, whatever the cost, all the more potent. The Gilliam style and the Gilliam humor are still here. No other director can quite choreograph chaos so that it flows like a symphony, and few can ring out the humor in a world so suffused with electronic communication that pizza boxes chirrup computerized greetings when they are opened. The Zero Theorem's thesis of what happens to humanity when its quest for meaning is diluted in digital noise and corporate manipulation is a compelling one. But a clearer vision was needed. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at MightyMoviePodcast.com. And if you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out CineFantastique Online over at CFQOnline.com.
I'm glad CineFantastique is still around in one form or another. And if you're wondering just about if Terry Gilliam's name is familiar and you've noticed that he's talking about Terry Gilliam's sense of humor, let me remind you where Terry Gilliam is most famous for. That was John Philip Sousa, Liberty Bell March, probably better known nowadays as the theme to Monty Python's Flying Circus. Terry Gilliam used to do animation there, and now he's a very, very good director. Directing animation, directing films, very similar skills. So, yeah, of course he can do that well. I'm Ken Gale. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And I'm joined by Mercy Van Vlack. Hi, Mercy.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, it is morning.
I was just reading in the Metro, they had a Q&A with Terry Gilliam on the meaning of life. And they talk about this is a more unpleasant protagonist than you're used to doing. And Terry Gilliam said, yeah, he's a self-focused bastard. He's obsessed with his own life and doesn't think about anything else. He's either a modern man, which is what I think he is, or he's who I became while making this, which is really disturbing.
Of course, well, the reason that I've got you on is that we went to the theater last Friday.
Lovecrack Festival.
On East 4th Street, they're doing radio play versions of H.P. Lovecraft short stories.
Radio theater.
And, it was interesting to see radio theater. It's basically several actors on stools reading or reciting.
And there's music and a lot of amazing sound.
Yeah.
The whole sound production.
Special effects, like you might hear on the Golden Age of Radio on Sunday nights. And... both of us are big H.P. Lovecraft fans, and so the idea of seeing this performed was pretty irresistible. And sometimes I wonder, should we have resisted?
Well, there's a certain amount of, it's in the book in one form, and when somebody else works with it, it changes. And some of the things, you know, there's artistic license. And sometimes it goes too far. I don't know. I really liked the first piece we saw.
Yeah.
Which was...
It was very short. And
the statement of Randolph Carter. It was really scary. You went down in the dark and you couldn't see, and he got horribly murdered or something down there, way down there. And he said, don't come down here because they're coming up. So there was this really terrifying idea of these things you couldn't even see coming up out of the bowels of the earth.
And one of the beauties of H.P. Lovecraft is that he left so much to your imagination, and they captured that pretty well when they adapted it. One of my favorite ways of relating how Lovecraft describes things is he'll do a paragraph where he tells you what something does not look like. So he said, well, it doesn't look like a frog, and it doesn't look like a lizard, and it doesn't look like a dragon, and it doesn't look like a... And what he's done is he's put so many images in your head that by the time you're done with the paragraph, you've got some impossible thing that is probably scarier to you than some other reader, because they're going to have something else, some other combination of all those images. Mm-hmm. And it's a very fascinating way of writing. Not too many writers do something like that. And it's rather brilliant in one respect, but of course it makes it difficult to film on another. Because you're going to go, well, that's not what it looks like. Even though Lovecraft never actually tells you what most things look like. Except for Cthulhu. You know exactly what Cthulhu looked like.
Well, I was just rereading The Dunwich Horror, which was the other piece we saw that night at Radio Theater. And it's astonishing how much he tells you about what that character looked like when he's lying on the floor in the library when he tried to steal the book and the dog tore him apart. And I've seen it drawn in comics. And I still don't know what it looks like. And I just read it, and I'm thinking, tentacles, and there were purple stripes, and there's a mouth on the end, you know, like an octopus, or, you know, very interesting, or like a lamprey mouth, you know, because these things are terrifying. And then he had skin that was like a reptile, but with coarse black hair all over it. I thought he was like a Pan, you know, sort of goatish character. And he was 8 feet tall. I've forgotten about that. You know, he's 8 feet tall when he was, before he... got rendered by this dog who just couldn't stand him and would go after him every time he saw him. Dogs hated him because he was a monster from another place. It was weird to read it again because the whippoorwill is a very important character in the story. And for some reason, the one we saw in New York had a pigeon substituted in the part.
Yeah, I mean, these peoples, they're dying and the whippoorwills are calling, which is a night bird, lives in the woods throughout From Maine to the Midwest.
The story takes place in Massachusetts in New England.
And whippoorwills figure in Native American lore and colonial lore. And they're kind of scary because you basically hear them. You never see them. And yet, substituting pigeons for them, it was as if they were turning H.P. Lovecraft into a comedy.
Yeah.
And the actors were turning H.P. Lovecraft into a comedy. And when I go to see or hear H.P. Lovecraft, I'm not expecting a comedy, nor do I want one. There are places I go for comedy, and there's places I go for horror or suspense or imagination, and Lovecraft is those. And the actors showed that they did not have to overact in order to perform in the first piece.
Oh, it was beautiful. It was really well done. I felt like we went down there. You know, it was scary. And the lighting and the way they were talking and, you know, you got a real sense of real danger. And
yeah, so why...
Exploring.
Why did they find a need to overact on the second piece? I don't know if it was the actor's fault. I mean, I guess you have to blame the director, really.
Well, talking about... I've got this essay that's... H.P. wrote Supernatural Horror and Literature. And one of the things he said in The Weird Tale, which is what he called his kind of writing, potency can be marred by flippancy. It takes away from the scariness. And then it just becomes a giggle. And people in the audience were enjoying it. They were giggling. But I was like, no, pigeons are not going to scare me. I was scared of whippoorwills for years. You never see them. You just hear this thing. And you don't know where it's coming from. And it matches the heartbeat of the dying monster.
And as a bird watcher, of course, you see them in the daytime camouflaged perfectly on a branch. And you never see them awake.
No.
And so, well, we all know what a pigeon cooing sounds like. This is what a whippoorwill sounds like. And imagine that in rhythm to somebody's breathing.
100 of them. 100 of them all gathered around the house. It's terrifying.
And I suppose they are thinking, well, nobody knows what a whippoorwill is and may not know it's a bird. So we'll use another bird. We'll use a pigeon.
Well, somebody said that he read something in a Robert E. Howard piece about pigeons from hell. And I don't remember that from my readings of Robert E. Howard.
I don't either.
And I said, but I think it's a New York conceit. And it's like, but the whippoorwill was always a scary thing because it was featured in quite a few of his stories. And that story especially, it's not like, oh, we threw in a duck instead, you know?
Right.
No,
yeah,
it's a very specific bird. It's out at night. You're not going to hear some birds at night. You're not going to hear pigeons at night.
And that's a screech owl screeching.
Now that's scary.
And, or he could have used this bird from the North Woods. And that's a common loon, which is on lakes. And I've lost track of the number of writers who talk about how chilling it is to hear that sound on a misty lake, because it seems that they always talk about hearing it in the mist.
In the dark. It's just getting dark.
Right. It's just getting dark, and they start hearing that.
There's a ghost on the lake. It sounds very eerie, I've heard.
So there's a lot of sounds. I mean, this was a radio play.
And that's a New England bird.
And yeah, and that's these are all New England birds. And so there's a lot of sounds they could have used in this radio play, and not pigeons. And you know, people laughed, and I suppose, you know, if you're laughing, you're having fun.
They had beer there, so people were happy.
And in talking to people afterwards, most people were saying that they enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, there were 30 students there. There was a class. A bunch of kids went there. They were studying Lovecraft or horror.
Well, no, they were studying media.
Media.
They were studying media.
Radio plays. Yeah.
So here's a book, mm-hmm. and a radio play and a stage production.
Oh, yeah.
And so they get three different types of media all at the same time. And
they were from Miskatonic U, right?
And I know that somewhere in the East Village is a bar that's decorated in
Lovecraft.
Bar. Yeah.
East 4th Street and Avenue B.
Oh, you know where it is. Good.
Because TJ was telling you to descend into the bottomless depths. You go down into this thing, and there's this whole setup. It's amazing. It's like quite outrageous and theatrical. The Lovecraft Bar. And they have people reading stuff there often.
And, in fact, the people who we saw doing the radio play have performed there.
Yeah.
And
it was fun. It was interesting, but you know, like I said, as a bird watcher, thumbs down.
Well, and as a
and then there was the red-tailed hawk. You know, there's scary sounds. There's rumblings from this mountain that sound volcanic because this thing is from another place, and there's displacements of air, and it's just like rocks grating together. Instead, we get the red-tailed hawk sound. You know, it's like what? Red-tailed hawk.
And I mean, the biggest problem I have as a Lovecraft fan is the comedy. They camped it up.
Be flippant.
And I really didn't appreciate camping up Lovecraft. And yet, you know, the reanimated movie is a camped up Lovecraft.
Yeah, but we couldn't watch that either. But that was for a different reason.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's because my uncle's in that. And he plays the head in the tray. And so, you know, I was watching the long trailer in front of the movie theater was playing. And there's my Uncle David. And somebody takes a shovel and chops his head off. And we're like, do we need to see Uncle David getting his head chopped off with a shovel? And we didn't go in. And to this day, I have not seen that movie. I've seen several of my uncle's other movies. He did one with Mark Hamill and Jimmy Walker, but I haven't seen that one.
This is very appropriate because it's Halloween month. It's New Year's Eve for the Celts.
And I think that's probably why they were doing H.P. Lovecraft. Because
he talks about Celtic circles a lot in his stuff. He runs through the Celtic and the Druids and things. He knows a lot about what was the popular literature of the day.
Well, it turns out that the whole... There's sort of a fantasy enclave that, you know, Robert E. Howard and H.P. Lovecraft and several other writers were part of who were publishing Weird Tales.
August Derleth.
And
Robert Bloch.
And they knew their mythology.
Fritz Leiber.
Leiber, yeah.
Fritz Leiber was part of that, yeah.
And they knew their mythology, and they didn't do it exactly because that's not creative writing. You don't just sort of parrot it. You do something with it. And, you know, Robert E. Howard did all kinds of stuff. I mean, Conan is a Celtic name. And there was a character named Conan in Celtic mythology, a minor character. And he used the name. He was nothing like the character in mythology. And, of course, not, because you already have the mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the way of thinking. There, I read an annotated Lovecraft that included At the Mountains of Madness and Dunwich Horror in Colorado Space. And in the annotations for At the Mountains of Madness, which takes place in Antarctica, it was written at a time when they were not sure whether Antarctica was one continent or two. If you look at a map of Antarctica, you'll see where two parts of it sort of go inland a little bit, like they're indented. And people thought that that was actually a strait, and it was frozen over. And you couldn't tell whether it was rock or a frozen ocean back in the 20s. And Lovecraft, you went to lectures, and he would listen to
science.
People. He went to a lecture where when the theory of relativity by Einstein was brand new. Mm-hmm. Lovecraft went to lectures of physicists who disagreed with Einstein and physicists who did not. To partly make up his own mind and partly just for grist for the mill. And he wrote to people about the lectures he went to and what he thought, I'll probably use this in a story sometime. So Lovecraft was a very, very intelligent man and a very well-read, very well-studied. And little bits and pieces of it popped up in the short stories, but of course the main thing was he's scared to be jeepers out of you.
Yeah, he was very good at that.
And yeah, he's considered, you know, the
not describing it.
the sort of the triumvirate of American horror is Edgar Allan Poe, H.P. Lovecraft, and Stephen King.
Well, I have a book here called H.P. Lovecraft's Book of Horror, and it starts out with an essay, Supernatural Horror in Literature, that he wrote in 1939. And in it, he talks about a story that impressed him by Edgar Allan Poe from 1839, which I thought was outrageous. 100 years. It was originally published in The Recluse in 1927, and then in The Fantasy Fan. He was in APAS. He was in the United Amateur Press Association in 1914.
And he was in NAPA, the National Amateur Press Association, which may have been the very first of all the APAs. APAs have kind of been supplanted by the internet. A lot of the abbreviations you see on the internet, like HHOK for haha, only kidding, or in my humble opinion, come from APAs, mostly from science fiction APAs. So the way of communicating just sort of transferred from amateur press alliances to the internet.
Less printing.
Yes.
But not as many pictures.
Much cheaper. And the comments aren't as long.
Yeah, they're more
simple. In APAs, people will go on for many paragraphs really forming their thoughts. And on the internet, if you go on for many paragraphs, it's somehow considered rude because people don't want to read that much.
Short attention span.
Which is really too bad. And you're listening to Hour of the Wolf on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And Mercy, what was the first H.P. Lovecraft that you read?
Oh, boy, I don't know, because I would probably have picked up a book of them, because by the time I came around, they were collected. I read everything in the library when I was in high school. Everything. All the books.
When you were in high school, they were not in print.
They weren't. Oh, maybe I got them at science fiction cons. I remember being very impressed with the Necronomicon. So maybe it was the Dunwich Horror. Maybe that was one of the first ones I read. Because of the whippoorwills just fascinated me. I was terrified of whippoorwills because of the way he described them. And it's a bird, you know. And years later, I finally saw them when I was birding. And I'm like, I thought they were black. You know, I thought they'd be horrible. And it's like, no, it's just a bird. Like the raven is so scary in the Poe story, in his poem. And I memorized the raven. You know, I was really into the birds even then.
I remember my first Lovecraft. I was senior in high school. And read an issue of Chamber of Darkness, the Marvel comic book. And there's a story in there called Music from Beyond. And I read that. And when I got to the ending, I was like, whoa. So I immediately flipped to the first page. Like, who wrote this? And it was written by Roy Thomas, illustrated by Johnny Craig, the great EC artist. Because I'd never heard of EC at the time. And then I saw in small print under it, and adapted from the Music of Eric Zan by H.P. Lovecraft.
Right. Wow.
And I'm like, I have to read more of this H.P. Lovecraft guy.
Amazing stuff. So you got the watered version first.
what happened was I went to the New York Public Library. I went to the card catalog, and they had a few Lovecrafts, but none of them were in circulation.
Huh.
And, in fact, none of them were around, and I asked the librarian about it.
Wow.
And he said, those books are gone. And if they ever came in, I would take it.
Wow.
The librarian was a big Lovecraft fan, but he couldn't find any Lovecraft to read. And it just wasn't. It wasn't in print. August Derleth was trying to get it back in print. He was a friend of Lovecraft's and was still alive. And he was trying to get somebody to republish H.P. Lovecraft, that this is a great American writer and is being forgotten and shouldn't be. And I remember finally at Brentano's bookstore on Fifth Avenue, there was The Color Out of Space by H.P. Lovecraft, the collection of short stories. And I got it and read it a couple times because it's all I had. And then finally, about a year after, they started coming into print little by little. So we're talking early 70s.
But it was actually not available for quite a while.
It wasn't available.
Oof.
And I was searching all over New York City.
It was so much fun.
I mean, back then, you did not find very many science fiction books in any bookstore.
There wouldn't be a shelf of them like there is today.
or a wall.
Yeah. I mean, there's stuff being published about him by now. I mean, a bunch of books just came out in 2014. I was looking on the web. And this one I got from 1993. You know, the collection of stories that he talked about in his writings.
It's interesting, when it finally came back in print, it pretty much stayed in print. There was
a
short
around.
Time it was gone, and then...
I've seen a lot of different editions in paperback and hardbacks.
With all kinds of strange illustrations. usually sort of, you know, a lot of non sequiturs and you know, the I don't know, how I'm sure if you're an editor, you're thinking, how do you sell a Lovecraft book?
With tentacles.
Yeah, with tentacles.
There's a band, an Australian band. They do black metal. And they've been around since 1994 to present. And they call themselves Portal. And supposedly they are in totally, all their lyrics and everything are inspired by Lovecraft and his stories. And I looked them up on the internet, and I found one called Glumierphonal. Is the word, and that's the only word he says, and then they go off and thrash and crash with all this guitar noise and interesting graphics in the background. It's kind of strange, but I didn't see there were many lyrics, but it's some kind of black metal from Australia, and they're totally devoted to H.P. Lovecraft. and the Elder Gods.
The problem with something like that is, are they devoted to Lovecraft because they're trying to get somebody to notice them? Or are they devoted to Lovecraft because they're devoted to Lovecraft?
They could be fans of it. They could have written.
After seeing those plays last Friday, yeah, I kind of wonder the same thing. Are they adapting Lovecraft because they know he's popular and people will go see them? Or are they into it? Because, and I, you know, the first one, I'm thinking, well, maybe they are into it.
Yeah, the first one was very, very well done.
But the Dunwich Horror, you know, turning it into a camp comedy, I'm like, well, you're not into Lovecraft then. And I don't know, you know, how to...
And there's like, when he wrote the story, there's a certain accent that's like the Hick country accent of old Maine or New England. So these are Massachusetts from a while back, you know. And they probably had a lilt to their talk, and they should have studied that and not had the southern accent, which they were developing. It's like, this is not the South, and you know, this is Massachusetts. It's got a whole other accent. It's the Kennedys or something. I don't know.
My feeling is...
You should study that accent.
Yeah, they knew that these people were supposed to be Hicks. You know, they're all from, Abby from a small town, and they don't like things that are very different.
They don't read. And the only book learning he gets is the old tomes, you know.
And the Whateleys are very different, so everybody distrusted them and everything else, and the mom was an albino, and, oh, we don't trust albinos. So they go, okay, well, they're Hicks. And as if that the only Hicks in the United States are from the South. And it's not like I'm full of Southern pride or anything like that. It's just that that's not the only... The only country folk are not from the South. There's country folk all over.
I grew up hearing about the Pine Barrens and the Pineys, and they're inbred, and some of them had faces like rabbits and cats and stuff.
And the Ramapo Mountain people, you hear the same kinds of stories.
New York Mountain and Pennsylvania Mountains.
And certainly we know in Montana they don't cotton to strangers there, you know, killing gay people. They some of the racism going on in Michigan. So there's country folk that don't tolerate people who are different.
They don't
all
cotton
over.
To them, no how.
They're all over the place.
Yeah, it's not just the South.
And so I was thought, that's a bit of a stereotype. You don't need to do that either. But for whatever reason, they did. And, yeah, I chatted with the producer before I saw it and didn't know what to say to him afterwards. He was just talking about how, hey, it's a sold-out performance. This is great. It's a sold-out performance. And
well, it's going to be there for a couple more days, so if people want to go check it out.
Yeah, like I said, people did enjoy it. So if you're really hardcore Lovecraft, you may want to go see just because you're hardcore Lovecraft, or you may want to avoid it because you're hardcore Lovecraft. I don't know. But do you have the exact address of it? It's on East 4th Street between...
Yeah, it's the Crane Theater, K-R-A-I-N-E Theater. 85 East 4th Street. The Crane Theater. And it's radiotheaternewyorkcity.com.
And it's only playing for a few more days.
And then they're going to have the best of 20 years of the H.P. Lovecraft films on Tuesdays until the end of the month.
At the same place?
Yeah. Plus, every Tuesday, October 7 to 28.
Yeah, I remember seeing a Boris Karloff movie that was supposedly an adaptation of The Color Out of Space. And
that'll be one of them.
Having read The Color Out of Space and having seen the movie, I had no idea that they were related in any way.
There you go again. When they get into another media, they change things.
But, I mean, there was, like, no relationship. I mean, I did not recognize The Color Out of Space in that movie until...
The comic book's done it better.
Oh, comics have done it better.
There you go. More of a media... It has better props or more visuality, more imagination. Is
Night Gallery did a version of Pickman's Model that was pretty good. And so did Marvel Comics. Marvel's done a lot of H.P. Lovecraft adaptations. And
there are a lot of different comic book people and writers who are inspired by Lovecraft. In fact, Stephen King was influenced by H.P. Lovecraft.
Big fan of Lovecraft.
And comic book people, Alan Moore...
Yeah,
Neil
Alan,
Gaiman,
right?
And Mike Mignola. They've got a lot of tentacles in their work. And older gods.
Well, let's listen to see what the listeners have to say about Lovecraft. The number here is 212-209-2900, and you're on the air.
Good morning. morning. What a lovely topic.
Yeah.
Okay, let's begin at the beginning. You mentioned pigeons aren't as scary as whippoorwills. Well, I got to tell you, you probably are right. But most people will agree that one of the best stories Robert E. Howard ever wrote was a story called Pigeons Out of Hell.
Oh, there it is. Again.
It's a great story. Let me also make a reference to the fact that you're right. Samhain is coming up in a few weeks. By the way, may I ask who the nice lady at the other end of your phone is? Because I tuned in late.
Oh.
It's Mercy. Mercy Van Vleck.
Okay.
Comic book artist and Lovecraft fan.
Yeah, you sound like you're a... You sound like you're also a bird enthusiast.
Oh, yeah.
I want to recommend a book to both of you. E.A. Armstrong wrote a book called The Folklore of Birds. It's part of the Naturalist series. Each chapter is a separate chapter on the folklore of various birds. And he has two chapters on the wren, which, even though a little diminutive bird, has a great deal of folklore around
it. That's true.
He also wrote a chapter, get this title, Night's Black Agents, which I think is from Shakespeare. And he talks about several birds that are considered very, very evil. Among them, the wren, because it is said that the devil created the wren on the 1st of May when God created the robin. You see, the devil cannot truly create. He can only mimic. And there are places where if you see wrens on the housetops or at crossroads, that means there'll be a death in your family. In Brittany, in Wales, in some other Celtic places. He also talked about partridges. He talked about the raven. Now, it's interesting, of course, that raven, some people think of as evil. You think of the ravens in the Tower of London. Supposedly, if all the ravens in Britain gathered at Land's End, it would mean the end of Britain as we know it. We also know that raven, of course, is a culture hero, as you know, Mercy, and... Who's the gentleman we're speaking to here?
I'm Ken Gale.
Oh, Ken. And you and I spoke a number of times. My name is Robert. I'm a friend of Jim Freund's. We spoke about folklore of superheroes once.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Neil Gaiman had Raven in one of his dreaming...
Yeah,
and Native American folklore, yeah, Raven's a good guy.
Raven all over the place.
Yeah, he's the one who opened the clamshell and let the human beings
he's
out.
He's also the one who brought fire and sunlight to the people. There are stories of Raven that run all the way from Northern California up the Pacific coast through British Columbia, through the Yukon, the Northwest Territory, all the way across Northern Europe and into Siberia. And, of course, he is a cultural hero. He's a transformative figure. He's a trickster. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he acts as a dupe. But, as I say, his is universal folklore. You mentioned Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman wrote a story once that has a great title. A Pint of Old Peculiar, which actually is the name of an old British drinking song. And
Old Peculiar Ale.
Yes, a pint of Old Peculiar. I could sing it, but I'm getting over a cold. Anyway, correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Lovecraft, and you two would know this, have a period in his life when he was very much into Lord Dunsany?
Right.
Did you ever read a story, and I always get it confused, this is a great story for telling, because it's short enough, The Cats of Ulthar.
Oh, yes.
You know remember how it begins? Same sentence, and ends. In the village of Ulthar, there is a law which states that no man may kill a cat. Punishable. Transgression is punishable by instantaneous decapitation. I hate to use that word nowadays, but it is a great story.
Yeah, Cats of Ulthar is an excellent, excellent story, absolutely.
Let me ask a question of you, too, because what movies, because you mentioned that there was going to be a Lovecraft film festival, what movies would you say were the best cinematic redoing of Lovecraft?
None of the above.
Oh, dear.
I really mean that. None of the above.
It's terrible what they do when they get a hold of stuff that they don't quite understand, and they try to make a movie and they can't figure out why it exists.
They
don't know why it works, and then they try to put it up there and it ends up being a farce or really awful, which is sometimes...
Didn't you mention, because I once saw, and this was many years ago, The Dunwich Horror, and I was not impressed.
I was not impressed either. And it was better than most of the others, which because the others were so bad. Pickman's model on Night Gallery did a pretty good job.
I like that.
I think that's a very easy to adapt short story.
Ken, I want to ask you a story, and I'm going to include Mercy in this because it sounds like you also are a movie fanatic like I am. What is it about Night Galleries? Now, look, I was a big fan of The Twilight Zone, the original. There are Twilight Zone stories, the Rod Serling,
sure,
that still stand today. The Monsters from Maple Street, Eye of the Beholder. We don't have to go into, I mean, there's just so many good ones.
And a lot of them were based on EC comic books.
They were.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when I asked...
Stories right out of EC comics.
And when I asked Al Feldstein, who wrote most of those stories, how he felt about Rod Serling ripping him off for Twilight Zone...
Oh.
His answer was, oh, we ripped off so many people. How can we complain when somebody rips us off?
Well, you know, there were certain Twilight Zones that, and I have to explain something, and not that it makes any difference. I'm visually disabled, but there was one story that got to me, and it's the one, I don't know the title, it's the one about the woman who lives on an isolated farm and a flying saucer lands at her door, and it turns out that these are Earthlings. And she's a giant, but you don't know it until the end when the guy says, don't try to send any help. Giant, a race of giants. And, of course, she batters the saucer to pieces. No, there was no dialogue in that story, Ken, if you remember it. It was a scary story. But let me ask you, what was it about Night Galleries that for some, and I liked, I mean, Night Galleries, there were some great episodes. What was it about Night Galleries that somehow never quite let it get off the ground?
I agree. It never quite did, and I always, you know...
I just didn't watch it. I didn't get it, so I wasn't watching it.
Well, looking at it now, I think one is that TV became much more commercial, and there was more money involved, and so it was more heavily censored. I think also because they weren't ripping off EC Comics.
They ran out of stuff.
Well, you know, for example, Night Galleries, I'll give you one particular story that was interesting, and this may have been based on a Manly Wade Wellman story. A bunch of German soldiers have stopped off at a castle somewhere in Transylvania. This old guy, by the way, is telling a story to his grandson about what he did in the war. And it turns out that the old guy is Dracula, and the castle was inhabited by werewolves and vampires. And, of course, at the very end of the episode, the Germans are overwhelmed and they're all killed. Then the old man says to his grandson, so if you hear people mocking the home front, don't you believe it. We did our part in the war. It was kind of comic, but it was scary. And as I say, there were some very, very, very interesting Night Galleries.
Some of them were interesting. And one was clearly a homage to Lovecraft.
Which one was that?
It was a college classroom, and I think our student's name was Lovecraft, and he was asking questions of the teacher. The teacher was reading from the Necronomicon.
Yes.
Things didn't end well for the teacher. It wasn't from a story, but I was like, well, that's a nice little nod to those of us who know who Lovecraft is. That was back in the days when it was not in print yet.
You know, as I say, Lovecraft, let me put it to you this way. The power to me of Lovecraft is the fact that a lot of authors from other genres, some good, some bad, attempted crossovers. Are you familiar with the fact that there are at least three that I know of collections of Sherlock Holmes stories that kind of bring in the elder gods and the ancient ones and Thulu and et cetera, et cetera? There's a collection called
Sherlock Holmes and the Elder Gods with Neil Gaiman.
Yes, and there's a collection.
Wait, was a Cavalier and Clay guy?
There's a collection called Shadows Over Baker Street,
right,
which is all Lovecraft.
Yeah.
Lovecraft and Holmes.
Do you know that one, Mercy?
I've probably read it.
Well, you know, I've even read some. I wouldn't say they're superior Westerns, but I've read a couple of Westerns. I'm a Western fanatic. I used to teach Western Frontier History to college students. And I like good crossover stories. And there are a couple of Westerns with definite Lovecraft overtones.
Cowboys and Aliens?
No.
I just saw that again recently. They don't have enough tentacles, though. It'll be Lovecrafty.
What did you think of Cowboys and Aliens?
I thought it was hilarious.
I thought it was funny.
I thought it was so funny to see Harrison Ford romping around on his horse, because he can ride. You know,
you know what?
He's got a ranch. And then to see James Bond hanging out with him, that was funny.
You know what I was waiting for? I was waiting for the Apaches to shoot down a spaceship.
Oh, yeah, with a spear and arrow.
With a spear and arrow.
Those guys are tough, man.
So, Mercy, let me ask you a question, because I know what Ken Gale has done, lots of comic books. By the way, is Jim okay? He's not sick, is he?
No, he's not sick. He's just...
No, that's fine.
Let me put you both on hold and take a little bit of break so those of us taping this can flip tapes and whatever.
And you should pitch to the website.
And yes, this is the pledge drive, but I will be right back in a few minutes.
Okay.
Hi, this is Donovan, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale of WBAI's Tuesday evening environmental show, Ecologic. One of the cool things about being a BAI buddy is that you get to decide what WBAI is worth to you. Are we worth more than your cable TV, or $10 a month, $20, $100, $1 million? Just go to the WBAI.org website and sign up with your credit card. You'll barely notice it. In return, you get a WBAI tote bag to show off, free or discounted entry to special WBAI events, and other perks. Another cool thing about being a BAI buddy is less fundraising interruptions to your favorite programs. Go to WBAI.org. You can donate in the name of your favorite show, like Ecologic.
And we are back. This is Hour of the Wolf. I am Ken Gale, substituting for Jim Freund. He will surely be back next week. And on the phone is Mercy Van Black.
Well, it's a raven. Buy a Ford.
And let's see if I can take a chance and bring in another caller.
Keep quick.
212-209-2900. You're on the air.
Hey, Ken. And Mercy. I always like talking to Mercy and stuff. So, hey, Mercy.
Hey.
My favorite vote for the H.P. Lovecraft movie would be From Beyond, which was really creepy when I saw it in the Midnight Show on 42nd Street. But I since have a DVD. I think it's, like, pretty faithful. There's also, what is it, a collection? I think it's literally...
When did From Beyond come out?
Late 80s. And it's made by the same guy that did Reanimator. And if your uncle is that part, if it's that character,
he's the head
do not
in the tray.
Watch that movie.
Yeah, don't watch that.
Seriously, people who watch the movie would know why. So, and you don't want to know why. So,
okay.
Do not watch the movie ever. Do not let your kids watch it. Do not, just don't.
Okay.
We were trying to watch it outside the theater because they
very
had, like,
good advice.
Okay.
Trailers,
especially, you know, it's like I watch something with somebody I knew in it, and it kind of detaches from the whole enjoyment of everything because it's like somebody that you knew is doing something like kind of weird in it, and it's like
I had a hard time with that movie, Werewolf and. American Werewolf in London, because I was going out with a guy named David who looked just like him. And after I saw that movie with what they did to that guy, I went out and had a Boilermaker, which I had never had one of those before. You'd take a shot of whiskey and drop it into a beer and drink the whole thing.
Wow.
Because I couldn't stop shaking. The thing they did to those people in that movie.
I also think it's...
I've seen some of my other, my uncle's other movies, like The Guyver and Singenor, and I have no problem with those.
But what I'm
and
saying
very,
is,
plays
is,
a very evil man.
The producer, director, I forget the guy's name, but he actually did From Beyond, too. So he kind of has an inkling of H.P. Lovecraft. And I think he did something else called the Necronomicon. So there's like kind of a trilogy of movies and maybe like one other. I'm forgetting about it, but it's kind of like the albino thing is in the basement. Collection that has, I agree with you about the Night Gallery Pickman's model, but there was also a series that did versions of Pickman novel. I have five volumes of H.P. Lovecraft collection. I don't know who put them out. I can look at this without knocking anything over in my my own crypt of horror over here. Yeah, H.P. Lovecraft collection, I am counting five. Well, four. Actually, it goes up to five, but I only have four of them. So it's like Out of Mind, Pickman's Model, Cool Air, Strange.
Cool Air, Night Gallery did a decent version of that, too.
Oh, that's right. But in this one, it's actually an actor, I think probably reading from H.P. Lovecraft's own writings. Very good actor depicting Lovecraft or something, and he's speaking into this old kind of like, like Art Deco type of microphone or something like that. I don't even know if they have radio back then, but he was saying things like, he used to have dreams. What I did know about him personally, his parents had a degenerative disease, and then both of them, like, went mad. And yeah. I think he had to take care of them. So he was kind of, like, fearful that it was genetic. But also the scary thing about his writing is that as you look at it, it's like that thing you can't stop looking at it, and then it kind of catches on like insanity or something like that. It's like, I've never slept since I read it when I was a very young child. So,
Well, the first caller was talking about the Lord Dunsany period of Lovecraft's writing.
I'm still here.
Yeah, yes. I have not hung up on you.
Good. Because I have a question I want to ask you.
And it's very dreamlike. The way it's written is very much in a dream state.
And you're right, it's half undescribed, so your subconscious kind of fills it in a personal way that kind of like fills up your nightmares if you do get to sleep ever. So I'd recommend it's very scary, but also there's a collection called, I have all this collection stuff, it's Horror in the Museum, which... And I think another collection, which I can't remember right now, but it not only has the H.P. Lovecraft stories, but it has the direct sequels that either August Derleth, Robert Bloch, or, I don't know, some other writers, maybe Mercy would fill in on what the other writers kind of contributed to the mythos that were fascinating. Because there's this one story that's the Lovecraft one, and then there's the other one that kind of like takes the whole myth mood, or maybe even the same place, and kind of like puts a sequel into it that's kind of like fills it up a little more.
You know, you mentioned just a couple of great writers, Derleth and Bloch. Derleth, of course, was to the Midwest what Lovecraft was to New England. He was considered a regionalist writer for places like Wisconsin, Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And, of course, Robert Bloch, most people may not know, you guys do. Of course, he was the original author of Psycho. Now, it's interesting, I was recently in the Midwest where they were having a kind of a Hitchcock film festival. They showed six of his movies. They actually showed Marnie last Thursday night. I'd never seen it. It's okay. Now, I've always said that my favorite of those was The Birds, but I'm going to say something. Anyone who has not read the Daphne du Maurier short story is missing something, because that is so much scarier. And I loved what Hitchcock did with The Birds, without music. The setting, of course, that fog-shrouded town up the Bodega Bay, up the coast from San Francisco. I know the town well. But the Daphne du Maurier story, WBAI, thanks to Max Schmid, I'm going to put in a plug for the Golden Age of Radio, did a two-part story.
Sundays at 7 p.m.
Yes, 7 to 9. And, of course, Escape and Suspense have done some great adaptations. But
I can't go on about how Gracie Allen is a genius too, and should be like rediscovered.
But they did a two part dramatization of The Birds, the Daphne du Maurier story. It was either from CBS.
Can I do a comment on The Birds?
Sure.
And there's something about Hitchcock I won't get into now because anyway, The Birds always drove me crazy because there was never any explanation. But then I heard like years later, and it's like I love things. It's like when I find out like I don't know my whole lifetime later about why. Supposedly, there was a Greek like tragedy about a woman who went to an island, and all the birds went crazy, like the Furies. And somehow they found out it was because of this woman, and then she had to leave, and I forget what happened. Does anyone know what that story is? Or
no.
But I heard it was like that. The Birds itself was based on that Greek tragedy about somehow the scorned woman went.